This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to CAMH.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Andy Mills is a journalist who I would be excited to have on the show based on his CV alone. He spent 5 years on the trailblazing Radiolab team, starting in 2012.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Three, two, one. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
And today on Radiolab, blame.
All right. So
tell me your name again.
Then he went to work for the New York Times, where he was on the team that created The Daily.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. In the time since the 2016...
The Daily is, of course, a juggernaut success that hasn't only changed podcasting forever, it proved that there is a way for a newspaper to reach online audiences that don't even read newspapers without sacrificing any of the depth of written reporting and while making millions and millions of dollars. It's hard to overstate how important that is, given where things are at with the newspaper industry writ large. His podcasting work for the New York Times won a Peabody Award, and it got a Pulitzer Prize citation. And based on all of that, I'd be thrilled to have him on the show to talk about his work. But that is not why he's on the show today. You see, the New York Times had to give back that Peabody, and the Pulitzer Prize board stripped Andy Mills and his colleagues of their recognition after another hit podcast that he co-created, Caliphate, fell apart.
It's a question most journalists have had to ask themselves at one time or another. What if this great story I'm chasing is too good to be true?
Was an award-winning podcast by the New York Times all just a hoax?
The central premise of this podcast was interviewing this guy who had served as an ISIS fighter in Canada and has not gone to jail. That guy, though, however, was just charged by Canadian authorities with fabricating ever going to Syria, meaning that the entire premise of the podcast itself, I don't want to say fake, but it's a lie.
You might remember the media scandal dubbed Caliphale. We did a whole episode on it back in 2021. Caliphate was hosted by star New York Times reporter Rukmini Callimachi, who co-created it with Andy Mills, who produced it. And it told the story of ISIS, the Islamic State. They centered their narrative on the story of a Canadian, Shiroz Chowdhury, a guy who said that he had traveled to Syria to join ISIS, where he actually performed executions on their behalf. But in 2020, after the Caliphate podcast was published, the RCMP charged Chowdhury with hoax terrorist activity. They claimed that he'd made the whole thing up, and Chowdhury later admitted in court to fabricating his story, and the Crown dropped the charges. When we first talked about Caliphate on Canada Land, we examined how a news organization as respected as the New York Times could make a mistake of that scale. And we took a close look at what the incident could tell us about foreign conflict reporting and about the use of cinematic podcast narratives as a storytelling format. But we didn't end our coverage there, because there was more to that story. In the fallout of the Caliphale, Andy Mills became a target of harsh online criticism. And who was this guy anyhow? Stories emerged of his problematic behavior at work when he was on the Radiolab team. He was known for asking out his female colleagues. He gave one of them a back rub at a work meeting. And, the worst of it, at an after-work social event, he poured a drink on a female colleague's head. This was all years in his past, and Andy Mills had admitted to it all, apologized, taken training, been punished for it, and passed over for promotion. His new bosses at the New York Times knew about it, and initially, they supported him. But as the pressure grew and grew, ultimately, they offered him a generous severance package to leave his dream job at the New York Times. Now, when we covered that part of the story, we reached out to Andy Mills with an interview request, but he did not accept. And to be perfectly honest, that was the last time I thought about Andy Mills. Until earlier this year, when he surprised me with an email. He reached out to me, not in anger or to settle an old score, but because he believed that I was in the, quote, midst of a public shaming myself. As you may remember, I have been facing a torrent of trolls since I began speaking up about the social and political fallout in Canada from the October 7th attacks in Israel. Mills wrote to me, quote, I don't believe you should feel ashamed one bit for standing up against hate crimes and vandalism, end quote. He offered me his friendship in case I needed to talk to somebody who might be able to relate to what I was going through. I took the opportunity to start chatting with him about other stuff. I mean, this was really a rare opportunity, really interesting to be able to have a civil conversation with somebody who I have covered negatively in the past. Most of the time, the only contact that you're going to have is a letter from their lawyer, or maybe a punch in the jaw if you happen to bump into them in public. So we started chatting about journalism and ethics and all sorts of things. And at a certain point, I just asked him, can we record this conversation? He said yes. And the one thing we both agreed this episode should not be is a conversation about so-called cancel culture and our respective experiences facing criticism and abuse online. As you will hear, we both broke that rule in the first few minutes. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Charlie Cook, Carly Marr, Courtney McLaughlin, Rena Silver, Jen Hubbert, Callum McCracken, Tsatsia Adzich, and Rocky.
My name is Rocky from Mission, BC, on the shores of the mighty Fraser River and land of the Stolo people. I'm a family man, community builder, and industrial technologist, in that order. I initially supported Canada Land because I found their various podcasts informative and engaging, and I try to vote with my wallet. I'm supporting them all now because as I age, I've come to value the role journalism plays in keeping power honest. We need more Canada Lands now, more than ever.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Jesse.
This is a really unique conversation in that it's not every day that I have just a conversation with somebody who had been the subject of our, you know, podcast of our journalism in the past.
Right. And not exactly a praiseworthy story as well.
Well, that's it. When somebody is the subject of critical coverage, of course, we reach out and say, we'd like to get your side of this. And then we understand that sometimes, for whatever reason, people choose not to. And if they choose not to, that's usually it. To actually talk about it like a couple years later was rare.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, I reached out to you because I saw that you were going through something online that not only have I been through a version of myself, but I'm interested in, had been interested in it before I went through it myself, and I remain interested in it today. And I sadly know from personal experience that it can be a really scary time, and not too infrequently people, they have serious suicidal thoughts. And as much as I might have been frustrated by the coverage on Canada Land of Caliphate and my own situation, I just wanted you to know that, like, most people don't think that way, and you aren't the worst things that people say about you on the internet. And I just wanted to make sure that you were around friends and that you had some support.
To bring our listener up to speed with where we were at with it, I accept certain principles about the work that we do. And I believe even in some of the cliches that get bandied about a lot, that our job is to afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted is maybe the more important part. But you know, yeah, I'm in the job of afflicting people, which is like a weird thing to be in the business of, like, yes, I'm trying to afflict the right people for the right reasons, but I accept that this work harms people. Mm. So when I find myself on the receiving end of criticism and I am being afflicted, I try not to feel too sorry for myself and just maybe even learn from this that this is something that I've put other people through. But where we were at in our conversation was a conversation about maybe looking again at that concept. Like, is it possible to do journalism that doesn't afflict someone, that does not harm?
What do you mean when you say harm someone? How do you define that?
Well, in the general dictionary sense, I think that, you know, it's sort of become jargonified, but synonymous with affliction. There's no point to me in doing journalism if it doesn't have some kind of impact, if it doesn't matter or have the power to change things. Mm-hmm. So when I say harm, that's what I mean, is like,
okay,
somebody's been getting away with something and our job is to figure it out and tell the world about it.
There is at the heart of what we do as journalists a power to change things. And I think that we want to be on the side of changing things for the better and not the worse. But I think that maybe where we start to diverge is this idea, and I've heard it a lot, that what social media did was it kind of democratized this power of journalism. Part of that's true, but I think that it fails to reckon with some of the negative changes that have taken place in the world of journalism. And I think the shortest way to sum that up would be to say, both on social media and too often in our world of journalism, there is a really big difference between publishing an accusation and investigating an accusation. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and it's so easy to publish.
I'm not trying to take a stance against all of the contemporary journalism or all of the social media forces. I definitely see the situation as nuanced, but I think that's a part of this disagreement you and I have about whether or not harm is an essential or even important element to what we do, and if it, in fact, is a part of the source of the power that we have.
So do we disagree? You know, I've done reporting on victims of sexual assault, and, you know, there's a very robust conversation in Canada about best practices for reporting on Indigenous communities that have been through terrible things, and to not be extractive. But the word harm does come up. It's like, there's a way to do this without doing harm. And I always push back a little bit on this solutions thing and on this, like, do no harm thing. Like, if those are the rules, I don't know how you could ever publish an important story. Like, is that something we disagree about?
When I'm hearing the word harm in the kind of New York progressive journalism world, I'm actually often hearing it in a way that feels like I have a bigger disagreement with that crowd than I do with you, which is this idea that we should do no harm, and they mean we should pay our sources when we talk to them, which is against most of the basic principles of journalism I believe in, or that even by going to tell their stories that we're somehow harming them. That being said, activist journalism has a long tradition and is fine. It's just not the kind that I seek to do, and it's not the kind that I think can be most impactful. So maybe, because you've done a good job of showing me how you got here, maybe I could tell you a little bit more of how I've gotten to where I am, and that can help make some sense of this. So I grew up in a small town, and like many small towns in America, very religious, and I had profound religious experiences that led me to believe that the most important thing in this world was spreading the message of Jesus Christ. And so I went to a Christian college to become a minister. But while I was there, I learned that things were a lot more complicated than I had been led to believe in my studying of theology and church history over the first few years I was there. It really led me to be less interested in an occupation where I would try to convince people to believe exactly what I believed, and more interested in trying to understand why anyone believes anything and how those beliefs inspire them to do things in this world. And that's ultimately what led me to becoming a journalist. And it wasn't an easy jump from one to the other. My first job was in South Sudan. I was there in 2007 and 8 as they were trying to form a country and dealing with this 20 plus year long civil war that they had just survived, and did a lot of reporting there about victims of sexual assault, sexual violence, people who had been raped, people had been murdered, whole groups of people who had been slaughtered. It was a humbling and powerful experience to be a professional listener and to professionally be curious about our fellow man's experience in a different part of the world and how those experiences shaped them, shaped their beliefs, shaped their desires, right? But it was also there that I started to learn about this other aspect of journalism that's important, because I saw what it looked like for a country to not have any journalism at all. Because I was traveling a lot throughout the country, I got to interview all kinds of people in all kinds of different situations, and I interviewed a lot of teachers. And what I heard continually from these teachers was that they hadn't been paid in months. And one day I pulled into this small village. They had a little tent set up. They were selling beer underneath the tent. And there was this guy there who was dressed nicer than everybody else, who was buying drinks for people, and people were patting him on the back. And I asked, who's this guy? And I learned, oh, this is the Secretary of Education. This is the Minister of Education. And I was like, is this the guy that hasn't been paying anyone their earnings? And he's like, yeah. And here he is dressed in a nice suit. He had a nice motorcycle. He was buying everyone drinks. And I thought, wow, in my country, I could expose this person. I could take some photos. I could interview the people. I could show the populace that this person who's supposed to be doing their job and isn't is here instead getting drunk with a bunch of people. And seeing like the different kinds of power that journalism had, both when it was present and when it wasn't, has definitely shaped the way that I've been a journalist ever since. I guess I wouldn't say that when you expose an injustice, like the one that I saw with this education minister in Sudan, I would make sure, I wouldn't try and say he's some kind of evil guy. Because it's not a good story if it's just, look at this guy, he sucks. The more you try and make this education minister in Sudan into these others, into these like abominable monsters people, the more that I think you're losing the power that the story really possesses at the heart of it. And I think that that's where maybe you and I have a difference of approach and a difference in our philosophy that we bring to the job.
I actually feel like we're just at a level of semantics here because, of course, if you were in a position to write about that that guy who's abusing his role in Sudan, he would consider himself harmed and would hopefully suffer consequences. I think what we're actually talking about here is that the kind of complicated stories that we seek to tell that might involve somebody losing some stature or facing consequences or told responsibly, that whole structure, which was easier to preserve previously, has now been reduced to binary dynamics of let's figure out who the bad people are.
I think that maybe this is a good place for us to try and weave together the two strains of this conversation, because I think they're connected. You have here in both journalism and in the public shaming economy a sense of, I think, tribalism over something like values or even something like profit. It simplifies it a little bit too much, but I think that the two strongest forces behind the public shaming on the internet phenomenon, one of them is kind of a good thing, which is the thirst for a more just world. at a time when people don't feel like they have enough power to make that just world. And you know what? They can join in on this online shaming, join the dog pile, and it feels like, okay, maybe we can leave the world a little bit better than how we found it. Even if it's just taking this person's job or getting this person to issue some kind of apology, like maybe we're doing our part. But I think the other one is the scarier one, which is the tribalism, that we're very social creatures down deep, and we want to be liked. We want to belong, especially right now when we don't have as much religious affiliation. We don't have the civic affiliations and civic engagement. Our tribes, whether they're about politics or something harder to define, they're meaning more and more to us. Mm-hmm. And this happens in the world of journalism too. I think some of the best reporters and best storytellers out there are being muzzled by a fear of being seen as too generous to the quote-unquote other side. I will say that when you're shaming somebody, especially in a public setting, you should make sure that you're shaming them for things they actually did or for beliefs they actually hold. And that is something that is very rare. And that's something that journalism could do a good job of correcting for.
Yeah.
I tried to do this with the J.K. Rowling documentary that I made.
Why do you like Harry Potter?
I had not such a great childhood.
Teaches, you know, the importance of friendships.
What do you think of J.K. Rowling?
So there's a lot of controversy with that one.
I'm Megan Phelps Roper, and these are the Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling.
I was not trying to say J.K. Rowling was right or she was wrong. What I was trying to do is show J.K. Rowling's views in the context of her life, why in the world she would say such a thing. Why this of all issues? Why does she think this is important? What are the stakes for her? And then talk to her critics about why they are not just upset, but they feel so hurt. And then go to her and get her to respond to her critics. And both of them, I push them both to be in the best faith possible, right? Like, because there's nothing wrong with arguing with J.K. Rowling's views. In fact, we have to argue with J.K. Rowling's views. And fill in whoever you want for J.K. Rowling, right? That's what makes a robust, open society. The trouble is when we start to shame, police, punish people for views that they don't hold, for things they haven't done because of that tribal instinct that I was talking about. And I do think that you have been guilty of that in your work. And I think that I'm hoping that your own experience with being at the center of it will cause you to second guess that notion next time, to make sure before highlighting some kind of public shaming that your facts are correct, that this is something the person has done, or this is a view that this person holds. And it's not just the least charitable possible interpretation of their actions or views because it feeds into some larger tribal instinct. And I say that all while at the same time saying, I'm not interested in telling a story called, I got canceled, I was so wronged, let me correct the story. I'm not trying to publish that story, I'm not interested in it. I'm just interested in human nature. Even when that story catches me up in it, I try to lead with curiosity to say, huh, what's happening, why? What's at the root of this? And that's me trying to stick to those ideals over becoming an ideologue and pushed into maybe becoming some kind of reactionary.
Well, let me react because I want to engage with the ideas there. But I'm feeling a little bit called out now. And what called in, Jesse? The first thing before we got to any of this conversation, when I first heard from you, when I hear from a source who we've covered in the past, especially critically, my first question to you is, did we get anything wrong? Years ago, when we reached out to you, you didn't write us back. But that there's no statute of limitations on an error. If we got something wrong, I want to correct it now.
I think you and I both agreed that we're not interested in relitigating a public shaming event from years ago.
Me neither, but then you said that we're guilty of maybe piling on. So
I don't think that it's unique to me, but I mean, I think if you want to look at mine as a case study, the framing of your guest who came on at the end of the episode, who specifically spoke about me, was that she was bringing up reasonable concerns about workplace behavior that was unprofessional and unwelcome. And that when she alerted Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily, to this on Twitter, this powerful media person blocked her, which is just a sign of people in media being unwilling to reckon with bad behavior. And that's just not what happened. I mean, your guest for many days was making accusations that I was a sexual predator and guilty of serious crimes.
Not on our show. We did not publish those accusations.
No, and I appreciate that. But after not getting much traction saying those things on her own Twitter feed, she began to, I don't know what you call it on Twitter when you write a tweet underneath someone's tweet, but she began to go onto Michael Barbaro's Twitter account, and whenever he would post the next day's daily episode, would use that platform to say that I was a sexual predator and that because Michael Barbaro and the New York Times would not distance themselves from me, that we should equate the New York Times with support for sexual predation. Now, once again, I'm not saying it was the right thing to do for Michael to block her, but I am saying that that context was important, and the fact that I'm not a sexual predator and that no one has ever even accused me, no victim of my predation has ever come forward, that's important. But it wasn't important to you, and it wasn't important to those who participated in the public shaming. And I'm not here to now shame you for how you did the shame. I'm saying that that's a microcosm of something bigger that's going on.
I wouldn't know what to correct if we were to correct that story. The context that you're giving me now would have definitely made that a better story. And we tried to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. And I'm not asking to run a correction. This isn't about me and my story. This is about you've now been in these shoes. And this is just me saying, I hope going forward that it will shape your coverage of things like this and that you'll do your best to make sure that you're remembering that there's a difference between publishing an accusation and investigating it.
I don't think it would have been possible for us to tell the story as media reporters of what was going on, this major media story about what was happening with Caliphate, without also talking about what had happened to you. How do we tell that story of what's going on without talking about what's going on with Andy Mills? And in telling the story of Andy Mills, we don't have the power to say, well, this is actually an unfair bundling of issues, because it's reality at this point. All we can do is reach out to you for that context so that we're not only talking to the person who is accusing you. So we do the best we can with the information that we're able to investigate it and report.
Let me just say, I you did reach out to me, and because I was working at the New York Times and their PR people's belief was that the less we said about all this, the quicker it would go away, a belief that never came true. I didn't speak to you, and I wish I would have. And I do think that if I had spoken to you, you could have gotten something better for your story. And so I only have myself to blame for that piece.
This happens to me a lot because I report on journalists.
But let me tell you why I think it happens in part.
Okay.
This gets to something bigger than me and you, which I think is the important part, is that there's no incentive for giving the context of a story like this. It would not have been hard to look at what people were saying on Twitter in my case, and it wouldn't be hard to look at what people were saying on Twitter in your case and quickly see that through the game of Twitter telephone, accusations were being accelerated, motives were being assumed, and a frenzy to see some sort of action was coming about.
Mm-hmm.
And even just mentioning that is a powerful thing.
Can I ask you this? At some level, do you have to agree to be canceled? You were targeted, but so was Rukmini. And I don't know whether or not they offered her money to leave, but she still works at the New York Times.
Oh, she's, yeah, no, her job was never at risk, no.
The Times PR people told you not to stand up for yourself and provide this context when me and I have to imagine a lot of other people asked you for comment.
Correct.
Do you wish that you had? When they told you that your journalism on Caliphate was airtight and that they knew about your prior newsroom right. stuff and they didn't have any problem with you, but they'd like you to leave because it's just gotten too hot. Did you agree to be canceled?
I think yes and no. I mean, once again, without relitigating the past too specifically and trying to think about the broader world of journalism, I will just say, yes, I wish that I had spoken to you and to other reporters. But I'll also admit that I didn't exactly know what to say. It was hard to find words in that emotional place because I was trying to live out my value of being gracious and listening to people and fighting the urge to be defensive while at the same time wanting to say, yes, I behaved in some very unprofessional ways. I did some things clearly regrettable and I'm sorry. But also, I'm not a criminal. I didn't commit crimes. Mm-hmm. And this has gotten to be less about me and more about this other interesting phenomena. And that wasn't a story that anyone, I think, was interested in publishing. And those were words that were really hard to find then. I mean, they're still hard to find now.
This episode is brought to you by Article, makers of incredibly good furniture. I didn't want a desk from Article because I just wanted a little shelf to function as a standing desk in my office. And, you know, a little two-person love seat couch thing from Article just so that other people could sit when they're in my office. I got to tell you, after about 10 minutes of standing every day, I find myself sitting in this very comfortable and stylish Article sofa in my office. I like Article for the workplace. I like it for my home. It's like I say, it's just where I go for reasonably priced but beautiful and functional and well-built furniture. They're so confident that you're going to like the experience that they are offering listeners to this podcast $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. That's a good deal. To claim it, visit article.com/CanadaLand and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/CanadaLand. For $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. This episode is also brought to you by Squarespace. So listen up, Squares. This is where you go for your website. If you just want a great one and one that is always going to be evolving. The web is still, I think, you know, the most powerful thing. And there's no need to build a website from scratch when you have beautiful pre-designed templates from Squarespace and everything under the hood you could possibly want. You can build with their incredible Fluid Engine technology. They can help you plug in an online store. They have an asset library, video collection, email campaigns, analytics, everything you need as your website grows. But for that first step, you can be there in like 1, 2, 3 by using one of their templates. Listen, head to squarespace.com/CanadaLand for a free trial. That lets you start building your website without paying them anything. When you're ready to launch it, use the promo code CanadaLand to save 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain. Once again, squarespace.com/CanadaLand. I'm interested in this story because I'm interested in taking a closer look at how people have been depersoned. And I'm interested in the phenomenon that you're describing in which I think we've created a whole lexicon of jargon to remove people's humanity. There's so many words that we use now that the effect of them is to shut people up. Whether you're, that's just both sidesing or that's just mansplaining or like there's a whole lexicon that if you say that word, what it means is we don't have to have a conversation. And I'm sure I've been guilty. I know I've been guilty of it even in not wanting to listen. When I first saw your show, I didn't know it was your show, The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. I'm like, well, right off the bat, I'm not interested in this. This is like that she's been put under a witch trial. Like that tells me everything I need to know about this from the start.
Yeah, well, it was a provocative title and I sometimes I regret it.
Well, for me, it placed it in a category of like, what is this from Quillette?
The hope was that if you listened to the whole thing, you would realize that there was this tension. Is she the witch or is she the one joining the mob? But once again, I understand why some people just seeing the title would have that reaction. I understand your reaction for sure.
Well, I'm glad I got over it because I like the show, but I also learned something like I'm going to spoil it for people, but it's not a plot point. Your host in the final episode lays out a rubric that I think is maybe one of the most powerful and important things I'd heard about how to navigate this age, which is she had grown up in the Westboro Baptist Church where she would hold up signs that say, like, God hates fags and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And believed, as one believes, the religion that they're born into, that she was doing the right thing and all of her actions were in service. It was a matter of belief. And then having, you know, seen the light and that realized that she was harming people terribly, she describes this crisis of like, well, how can I trust any conviction I have anymore? Mm-hmm. How can I trust anything that I think is the right thing to do if I was so wrong about that? So that's how she comes to laying out the questions that she asks herself now. And I'm going to try to paraphrase them. I'm sure you can correct me if I get them wrong. When she's really sure that she's right and operating for right, she asks herself, is there any evidence? If evidence brought me to this conviction, is this a conviction or is it a belief? I want it to be a conviction. If it's a conviction, if I'm right based on facts, then there should be other facts that could disabuse me of this conviction. If I was wrong about those facts, is that possible? Could I be presented with evidence that would change my mind?
Right.
And if the answer is no, you probably are like in a cult or you have a religion, a faith, not belief. One of the questions was, could I fairly summarize the other person's point of view?
In a way that that person would recognize as their point of view.
Yes, that is my argument. That is what I'm saying. And so few people, I think, would be able to do that. And then the third one was, am I willing to behave in a way in support of my conviction that I otherwise would never be willing? Am I willing to call somebody a horrible name or say that they should die or should kill themselves or try to get them fired or do all sorts of antisocial things that I'm only willing to do because I'm so goddamn sure that I'm right? Was there a fourth one? Those are the three that I remember.
Am I attacking an idea or am I attacking a person? I think was another aspect of it as well. This difference between I really think that J.K. Rowling is wrong, or I really think that the critics of J.K. Rowling who are saying that she's an anti-trans bigot are wrong. Am I attacking that idea, or am I just attacking the character of the person?
Have I moved to ad hominem? And at that point, we're just at war. We've decided who the enemy is, and there it then becomes good to destroy people. So this is like the Four Commandments for our era. I thought, I'm glad I listened to this podcast because those are important questions for me to ask. And I think those are like, I don't know, put them on a stone tablet and, you know, those are good questions for right now.
Well, I will say that I totally agree with you. I think that Megan Phelps Roper, she's not only one of the best friends I've ever had, I think that she is a moral hero. And I think she lives out those morals in a way that is admirable. I think few people have been hurt by her family more than her. They've completely cut her off after 20 plus years of that being the only life that she ever knew. And yet she refuses to see them as anything but people. And she refuses to think that who she was back then was just some other person. She's willing to reckon with the fact that her family did love her, that maybe in their own way they still do love her, and yet they're behaving so horribly because they are so sure that they are just, that they are right. And she also is so good at showing that actually there's an aspect of courage in what they're doing. They know that what they're standing up for isn't popular. They know that people are going to attack them and boo them, throw things at them. And yet they think that it's worth it because they're right. They've just lost sight of the ability to question the foundations of their own beliefs, but they're not evil people. And Megan, she has to reckon with the fact that she wasn't evil then and now she's good. She's still that person down deep inside. And I think that that's a really beautiful but difficult way to live with humility. And to put this back to our subject about journalism and the problems of it, I mean, there's a reason, I think, that polls show that consumers of news and politics, they are consistently the worst at articulating the views of their political opponents. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. And I think it's related to this larger problem that we're talking about. And I don't think that it's one we can't handle. And I know that there are so many good journalists out there who are hungry and willing and able to do it. And like I said, the good news is that telling a nuanced story that actually tacks on to reality, it's powerful and people are hungry for it.
I want to shift our conversation to your role in helping to create The Daily, which I think more than any other podcast executed some of these ideals that you're describing here.
Let me just say, to take you back to the beginnings and to do more than just thank you for your compliment, which I do. You know, Theo Balcom, Lisa Tobin, and myself, that was the original producing crew for The Daily. You know, we were all new to the New York Times when we started The Daily. And we were aware that this growing distrust that people had in the media in general included The New York Times. And we intentionally hoped that The Daily, in how we produced it, how we told stories, the reporting that we would unpack, we hoped that it would rebuild trust in these institutions, and specifically at The New York Times. And part of that was acknowledging that some people think that The Times is full of a bunch of left-wing ideologues, and we wanted to show them that that wasn't true. Part of that was knowing that some people who tune into The New York Times are more left-wing ideologues, and we wanted to show them people and voices that would burst their echo bubble. And there were a lot of people who didn't like that. I mean, we had early on this interview with a coal miner that was very moving. And back then we were still trying to figure out the sound of the show and everything. But we had this, you know, moving interview with this coal miner who had supported Donald Trump. And, you know, the amount of blowback we got on Twitter, the amount of hate emails we got from people who were just absolutely, I'll never listen to The Daily again, was big. But we didn't listen to that. We didn't cave into those pressures and apologize for what we had done. I think that that was key to our success, that we were intentionally trying to make something that was an embodiment of these strong ideals that we possessed. Great storytelling, nuance, pushing back against assumptions when they don't align with the truth, piercing people's echo chambers.
What's missing from that list of really nice ideals and goals for The Daily, when we're talking about the secret to its success, is that it made us know and like reporters in a way that I think that the sometimes dehumanized and bloodless convention of the way in which reporters write copy does not allow us.
Once again, that was intentional. We not only wanted you to see this is a real person who really went somewhere and tried to figure out what was going on and is now coming to talk to Michael to do their best to report accurately what they witnessed and what their reporting showed. We wanted to do that. But we also were always encouraging our reporters to answer Michael's questions with, you know, I don't know that. I'm still looking into that. That's something I'd like to know as well, to let people know that we don't have it all figured out. And I do think that the medium of podcasting, as strange as it is providing a real hope for the future of our democratic experiment and the role that journalism can play in it.
Are there pitfalls, though? Because the conventions of this medium, of everything being a narrative, of trying to present characters in a news story not dissimilar to the character in a really gripping movie, were some of the problems that surfaced with Caliphate a symptom of prioritizing the conventions and what's powerful about podcasting above some of the more facts, just the facts approach that might be in a traditionally reported news story?
I've heard that criticism before. There's a media critic who I'm friends with who has published that theory. And I do think that there is some wisdom to be gleaned from that. I don't think that that lines up necessarily with my experience as being the producer of that podcast. I think that that story is a bit simpler and at the same time more complex than that. I mean, the way that I would say it is, if you listen to the podcast Caliphate, which is still up and I recommend people do, I'm still proud of it in many ways, you'll see that at the heart of the podcast, there is an acceptance of quite a lot of doubt. And we play with doubt and we try to do that thing that we were saying The Daily does of showing the work. And I do think that ultimately there wasn't a big appetite for doubt especially during the Dean Baquet era of the New York Times. I mean, this media critic took me out to drinks not too long ago.
Who are we talking about here?
Ben Smith.
Oh, okay. At Semaphore, yeah. Formerly the media columnist of the Times.
Right. And I think he said it well, where he said, you know, first he told me, I'm sorry, you're not famous enough to get canceled, which I thought was funny and true. But he said, you know, he went and listened back to a bunch of my work, including stuff I'd done at Radiolab, and re-listened to Caliphate and said, oh, everything you do has this, let's not get so caught up in certainty and this acceptance of doubt. And ultimately, that was going to be difficult because, you know, especially during the Dean Baquet era of the New York Times, there wasn't an appetite for that doubt. We want to know, is it true or is it not true? So we tried to show the audience all the places where we could not confirm certain aspects of this guy's story and other places where we were catching him in lies. But ultimately, we wouldn't have published it if we thought we were being duped. And so the struggle just becomes, well, what do we do years later after winning all these awards and getting all these accolades? What do we do when new information comes out that makes it look like, oof, we really might have been duped? That's a tough place to be. And for me, my instinct then, and it remains my instinct now, is I think we should have just shown our work. You know, I was in an emergency phone call meeting with leaders at the New York Times after our subject had been arrested by the authorities there in Canada and charged with this terrorism hoax charge. And we were saying, what should we do? And I said, well, number one, we should record this conversation we're having right now. The listeners are going to want to know.
It's all content, baby.
We've got a season two. You know, this is a part of the bigger process. What should we do? And I was told, absolutely not. And I said, why? Don't you think the listeners would find it interesting to see how we handle this situation and how we reinvestigate whether or not we got aspects of the story wrong? And I'll never forget, I was told, Andy, our job right now is not to do anything interesting. And I think that it was a mistake. They treated it like a PR problem that needed to go away, when I still think that it would have been better for us to just show where we did get things right, where we may have fucked up, and just continue to show the listeners that it's real human beings that make up these reports, and we're doing our best, but sometimes we do make a mistake.
Did you?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, if we knew then what we know now, we would have done a different series.
You might have killed the whole thing.
Well, yeah, we would have. I mean, I think people forget now just how massive ISIS was. There were so many stories to be told.
Sure.
And the idea that we would tell a story, that we would take this much time, put this much effort into telling a story that maybe wasn't true? Yeah, I don't think we would have done that again. If we had known then what we know now, we definitely wouldn't have done that again. And let me just say, I wrote most of the music for that. I was the lead producer for that series. You don't even understand the amount of hours I spent with that guy's interview tape. And to think that he might have been making it all up is awful. It's embarrassing. And it's also a waste of an enormous amount of resources. If that's what actually happened, which, you know, it may have been what happened. We still don't know.
Well, the RCMP charged him with making it all up, and he admitted to making it all up in court. Do you still think that Shiroz Chaudhry was a member of ISIS who went to Syria and fought with ISIS and plunged a dagger into somebody's heart and all the stuff he told you?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew. It definitely seems more likely than not that he was a fabulist. But I don't think I'm ever going to get the certainty that I would love to have when it comes to that story.
It seems like you are leaving a little bit of room for it to maybe still be true that what he told you happened.
Yeah. I see no problem with eschewing certainty in this case. I mean, maybe some of it's related to like how I used to be a fundamentalist Christian, and now people are like, so you're an atheist? And I'm like, kind of, but after being so certain for so long, I'm not interested in that kind of certainty. And you're saying, well, this guy, he's saying now that he made it up. Shouldn't you believe him? And I'm like, well, that's the same guy who told me a heart-wrenching story about him murdering people. So his testimony is not what I'm interested in placing that much weight on at this point. But yeah, I mean, if I were a betting man, would I bet that he was a fabulist over not? Yeah, probably.
If I were in your shoes, this would bother me more than whatever the New York Times should or shouldn't have done. Like, as a journalist, that uncertainty, and here we're still talking about conviction versus belief, because right now it would probably be much better for you if you just accepted what the consensus reality, everybody is basically like, it's done. The New York Times has retracted the core of the story. The awards were given back. It had career ramifications. It's done. The story has fallen apart. Move on and rebuild. But the factual record, you don't have the evidence necessarily to come to a definitive 100% conclusion. Do you fantasize Correct. About like traveling to Syria and like getting to the bottom? Like, wouldn't that be the sequel? As if it actually fucking was true and you could prove it. But then, but now you're in the story, so you can't be the one to do that. Like, you've got a conflict of interest because it would be too good for you if it actually turns out to be true.
Yeah, well, I'll just say that, you know, that was a part of my pitch when I pitched this idea of Caliphate season two, where we show our work and we show how we try to reckon with the fact that he may have been a fabulist. I was like, we should go to Syria. Things have calmed down there. The Times decided they had other things for me to do.
I want to be in that pitch meeting where the PR department that just wants this to go away yesterday because the entire credibility of the New York Times is at stake. They're like, yeah, let's do a sequel. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it turns out they weren't into it, Jesse. They didn't want to do it.
I don't think anybody listening to this, including the many journalists who listen to this show, can relate to what you experienced and what I think some other journalists at the New York Times are experiencing right now. The level of scrutiny, because the Times is the paper of record, because when they publish a blockbuster investigation, it matters and it has impacts, because it's something that somebody didn't want to see published. When a story falls under scrutiny and it's a New York Times story, I've been involved in highly contentious stories that have had a lot of people, other journalists trying to take it apart, armies of people online trying to find fault with it. But I don't think that I've experienced what a New York Times reporter would experience when a bombshell like that starts to fall under scrutiny and suspicion. It's an onslaught.
Mm-hmm. I do think that we should clearly delineate, though, the difference between people who are critical of the journalism and want more evidence, want more proof of account before they're going to believe. That's a healthy skepticism. And that's another aspect that we need much more of in a pluralistic society, is being skeptical of what we see, yes, on social media especially, but also in the media. And I think that skepticism is par for the course. I do think that the other kinds of scrutiny, going through someone's old tweets, seeing something that you don't like, trying to define their entire character by that tweet, taking some thing that somebody said or did that maybe is regrettable and trying to define their entire character and reputation on that thing just because you want to out them, you want to punish them, which once again, I've already acknowledged, I think some of that comes from a good place. There's a desire to make the world more just. And if you're feeling helpless and powerless, it can feel like you're on the right side to join in and dogpile along with the rest. But I do think that is a different lane, and I don't think it's good. I think you've seen this happening a little bit with Emily Bazelon, Megan Toohey, and other New York Times reporters who've done some reporting around the debates surrounding youth gender medicine. Mm-hmm. There is a total damnation of the intent and the character of this reporter because they would dare even acknowledge a debate. And this just gets at this larger aspect that I was talking about earlier. There is a desire to be told what you already believe and to see journalism as an extension of tribal politics.
the anti-trans people are going to use that. But if it's true and the reporting is sound, even if an anti-trans person tries to use that to make their argument, in your argument against the anti-trans person, you can acknowledge, well, this thing is true, but that. To pretend otherwise is not good for the open debate in society. And I don't think it's even good for you as you're making your argument against them.
What's your next project, Andy?
Well, you'll be surprised to learn I am making podcasts. I'm working on a new show called Reflector that hopefully will be out in the next few weeks. And it's a storytelling show where each episode is a new story, a new topic, a new debate happening in our world. And we bring a similar approach to it that we brought to The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. Instead of trying to tell people what they need to think and what's the right thing and the wrong thing to believe, we look at something like third-party candidates for president or rap lyrics being used in a criminal case or these new medications that are being used to treat alcohol addiction. And through storytelling, we try and show what's at stake for people who are involved and why so many people are coming to different conclusions about what's right, what's wrong, and what the world should do. And I hope that it's something that your listeners will like, and maybe even you, Jesse. Maybe you'll come on as a guest one day.
Andy, it's been terrific talking with you. Thank you.
Jesse, this has been a strange but lovely encounter. Thanks for having me, and I hope that you feel as good about it as I do.
That's your Canada Land podcast. Listen, Andy Mills and I actually spoke for a lot longer, and it was all pretty interesting. If you're a supporter of the show, there is an extended version of this podcast waiting for you on your feed. Listen, we really try every week to bring you something new, an original report, analysis, a conversation you're not going to hear somewhere else. You know this, you just listen to one of them. And if you value this, you might know somebody who would like it as well. There's just a lot of people out there who don't know that this free thing exists called Canada Land. This is how our audience has always grown, by asking our listeners to tell other people to give it a try. If you think you know somebody who might like Canada Land, please let them know. Or you can also help us by reviewing and rating this on Spotify or Apple. If you want to support us directly, that is how this company keeps the lights on. You can do that at canadaland.com/join. You can email me. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email you send. Our website's canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Our production coordinator is Andre Proulx. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication's handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. You can listen to Canada Land ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.